Thank you for allowing me to be a.
I would now like to welcome our speaker, Leslie from Atlanta, Georgia.
Hi, thank you so much. Thank you to the group and the committee for inviting me out just to hear my spiritual experience and my journey to this point today. I am my most sober right now than I've ever been in my entire life. My name is Leslie Strange. I'm a recovering alcoholic. My sobriety date is November 2nd, 1988, which means I have 33 years of continuous sobriety. And like Candace, you blew me out, man. You have so many stories. I need to sit down with you and get the in-betweens because it was just so phenomenal from what you recovered from. I was 28 years old when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous based on another substance that gave me more ability to drink longer and more and harder and all of that. But I remained to stay. I took one white chip. I didn't come in and out of recovery. Once I got in here and I sat all the way down, it was over for me. I surrendered after 10 years of hard drinking. I don't know when I embarked across the invisible line. I just knew that there was a point in my soul that I knew that I was done and I couldn't stay stopped. I could not get started. I couldn't do any of that. And that's been my story. I'm supposed to share in a general way what I used to be like, what happened, and what I'm like today. And I was talking to a good friend of mine, because that's what you get around here. You know, you learn to be a friend and you become friends with people that you get sober with. It's nothing more joyous than to grow up with someone in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous that knows where all the bodies are buried, and you know where their bodies are buried too. You know where all the bones are, what closets to go into, and it's something comforting in having a friend. You may fall out with that friend, and then you get back together. It's like a intimate relationship of another variety. And I was talking to my friend last night, because I had a reminder of some things. And then to add to that, Candace just put the icing on the cake. And I started thinking back about the stuff that I selectively hid or didn't selectively, subconscious stuff. You know, this is an onion layer, onion peel layers and layers and layers and years of trauma and stuff that you start thinking about, like, wait a minute, did I do that? And then you don't have a form of reference. All you have is your own perception or your own story. So what I try to do is be as honest as I possibly can and try to tell you and reveal to you what I recall. Some of it could be off. My timeline could be off a little bit. But I remember things that happened to me. So when I talked to this friend last night, I had her laughing. She has COVID, by the way. So it's nothing nice about calling your friend with COVID and their chest hurts when they laugh. And I'm a laughing person. I can make anybody laugh. And her chest was just, don't call me with this. And we were laughing. And you would think these things would make someone not want to tell, you know. And I was thinking about my recovery, because when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt like I didn't have a story as drama filled or as exuberant and so full of stuff like Candace. I would hear stories like Candace's and stories way worse. And I would sit as this little 28-year-old girl going, well, I didn't do that. Well, I didn't have that experience. I didn't sell off my children. I didn't have any kids. I had a good job. I had an apartment and I had a car, and I was sitting there lost. See, but what I've come to find out in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous is this. I found out that I've had some stuff that I did that I forgot about. I mean, some real stuff that I forgot about. So I went on this string of stories of telling my friend this, and it went a little something like this. When I was, I went to Catholic school, and my mother had a really, really good job. She lived on the west side of Los Angeles, and she was a veteran of the Army, and she bought her house on the west side of LA with her VA plan and, you know, all of the different stuff that she got. And she put my brother, it was just three of us. It was me, my brother, my mom. And we didn't have cousins. We didn't have grandparents. We didn't have aunts and uncles. We had some third or fourth cousins removed, but it was just the three of us. All my life, all I knew was the three of us, because she left my dad when I was little. And it's something about feeling like you don't get that love language from your mom. So for me, if you're like me, you seek that love and that affection and whatever you think that's supposed to look like, you go to outside people to get it. I was the little bitty skinny girl that they used to tease in school because I was always small. When other girls were developing, I was flat chested. They used to call it the itty bitty titty committee. I know that sounds kind of rude, but that's what they used to call me. They talk about my eyes, you know, the whole deal. So that didn't help. I had a mother who was a tough mom. She did a great job at raising us. Of course, I didn't figure that out until I was today years old in sobriety, that she really was a good mother and did the best that she could. So everything I blamed on her. But as I look back at it, I was telling my friend, you know, most of my damage came when I was about 18 years old. See, I was a little girl that was always searching for somebody to love me in the manner that I thought love looked like. A kiss on the forehead, a hug, a flattering thing. You're so pretty. You're so good. You're so smart. And I never got that from my mom. My mom's love language was making sure you were dressed, making sure you had the best clothes, making sure you had the best food, make sure you went to the best schools, make sure you had some cultural experiences, flying to San Francisco for the day and flying back, flying to San Diego, taking the red car into San Ysidro and walking across the border and hanging out for a day in Tijuana. My mother did a lot with my brother and I because it was just three of us, so I guess it was affordable for her. But then all of a sudden I discovered boys. And from day one, from the time I was 16 up until not too long ago, I used to always think if I just had a boy that liked me, that I would be okay. My value system of love was placed on another person. I always depended on outside sources to make me feel good inside. So I started going out with this one boy. He was real popular. He was really, really cute and everything. Then I found out he was messing around with a girl who was prettier than me. I mean, that's back in the day when it was the Farrah Fawcett flip back. You know, yeah, even black girls tried to do that. You know, you curl your hair and you flip it back. Well, my hair wouldn't quite flip back because I didn't have that kind of hair that would flip that way. So it usually stopped right here and it stuck out like that. And so I didn't quite fit the bill, but I tried. And he started liking a girl that looked better than me, so my head told me. And he never let go of me or quit me. And then when I found out, I was devastated. So as time went on, I kind of healed over that for whatever reason. And I've always been the girl that sought out a guy that picked me. Always. I was telling my friend, I used to go to a club called the Red Onion on Wilshire. And I know this is San Fernando Valley and a lot of you guys aren't here. So I apologize if I mention places you don't have a clue what I'm talking about. But I used to go to the Red Onion, honey. It was comedy night, ladies night, free before 10, taco night, whatever night it was, I was in the club. So after I get off work, I change my clothes, you know, because I don't know about you, but I lived out my car. My car was a closet. I'd have a shoe in the front seat and a shoe in the back seat. I had extra underwear, different pairs, different clothes that I came out of. I'd leave the house in this dress, and if I didn't like that dress, I'd change in the car. I'm a great car changer. I can change in the car in a nanosecond with about a half inch space. I can change. If you're a real alcoholic like me, you can change clothes anywhere. You know what I'm saying? So I would go to the club, meet my friends out at the club, and I had two other girlfriends, and that was back in the day when you bleached your hair blonde. So it was three of us about the same complexion, three blondes. It's almost like three blind mice, three blondes. And we'd go out to this club, honey, with our bodycon dresses on, greased up legs, greased up like a gas station mop with our pumps with the cleavage. I don't know if y'all know about toe cleavage. You know, you had your pumps on, and between the three of us, we'd have just enough money to buy one Corona apiece. And we'd sit there and nurse those Coronas because we knew that somebody like Ralph White or somebody like Mark Nelson or somebody like Steve Lamb would walk in and see these pretty cute girls and they would buy us drink. And we'd walk out of that club, the drunkest three of the whole club, and started out with 50 cents a piece. That was the deal. That's how we did that. We were basically prostituting ourselves for a drink. And the three of us would go out. So there was this real smooth, and see, something... It's always been that something that told me, no, he is no good. It'd be like he had a neon blinking sign, you know, that said, "Nope, don't mess with him. He ain't no good." This guy was tall, dark skinned, handsome, had on a suit, didn't drink, didn't get high, didn't smoke no medicinal marijuana, didn't do nothing, had this perfect beard and perfect mustache. And he walked up, sidled up to the bar, and he said, "Hi, my name is Demetrius," whatever his last name was. And he came at me. And so all of a sudden, he bought us rounds and rounds. And every time we went to the club, he would be there, and he'd buy us rounds and rounds of drink. And it was so funny. We had the gall, the unmitigated gall, to drive home drunk. One of us would drive. Wasn't a nothing about no designated driver in the early 80s. Designated driver, it was whoever had the keys. Are you kidding me? We got to get home. I had to work the next day, you know. So we would get to the bar and we'd drink, and he'd buy us drinks. And so, of course, he and I started a relationship, because that's what I do. You know, once I sleep with you first, even if I met you on the first night, we go together, okay? It's me and you, we go together. So I started dating this guy. So this guy tells me this story, and I said, "Well, what do you do for a living?" Because during the day, he would be home while I'm at work, and when I'm coming home, well, by the time sunset, he's getting ready to leave, right? So I asked the guy, I'm like, "Demetrius, what do you do for a living?" You know, of course, I slept with him first. I didn't ask him all these questions first. I probably didn't know his middle name. That's how I roll, okay? So I asked him, "What do you do for a living?" He said, "I work for the sheriff's department in Altadena." I said, "Oh, so you must work swing shift, because you leave the house about 7, 8 o'clock at night." And he said, "Yeah, I work swing shift." I said, "Okay." So we're going back and forth, and he always had this routine. He would leave about 8, 9 o'clock at night, 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night, and he'd be gone. He'd come in at 6, 7 in the morning. This man comes in 6, 7 in the morning, and when he would come in, he'd come in with piles and piles of clothes. Now, I don't know about you, but if he works for the police department, how is he getting all these clothes and fashion jewelry? And my living room would be stacked up with leather. That was back in the day of Eddie Murphy leather. I don't know if y'all remember the Eddie Murphy leather outfit. Leather skirts and dresses and all these fancy things and artwork and furniture and stuff. And I'm like, "Wait a minute, you work for the police department." He just said, "Oh, it was a bust, and this was what was left over, so they let us have it." I believe that. See, I was so naive. I was so naive. I believed anything a guy told me. Just love me. I didn't care what you said you did. I believed it. I took it on face value. Then one day he didn't come home. So I'm sitting there and I'm waiting for him to call. I'm blowing up his phone. He had one of those little flip phones back in the day, and there was no pagers or nothing. I'm wondering where he is. I don't know where his mother lives. I know they live up in Altadena somewhere, and I'm blowing. So I call Altadena Police Department, right, girls? We know how to track them down, right? We were the original LoJacks, by the way. You know, we could always track a dude down. I don't know about you. I could find out who his ancestor. I don't need ancestor.com. I can find you. You know what I'm saying? This is before Google and all of that. So I call Altadena Police Department. I give him his whole name, and they said, "We don't have an officer with that name that works at this station." So I went on and called Pasadena City Police or Sheriff's Department. I called everything. Nobody knew who this guy was. Now, this is after we moved. Now we're shacking together. We moved in together. All this stuff is at my house. We've been sleeping together for quite a few months. Can't find the guy. Come to find out, he gets released. He comes home. And I said, "What happened?" And that's when he told me the truth. He was a straight thief. Now, let me give you a clear picture of what this looks like. Because see, me and Ralph talks, and every time I tell Ralph another story, he'd be like, "You didn't tell me that." I was like, "Oh, I forgot." So it's okay. This guy comes home. He says, "Well, what he does is he, on Melrose," I really believe, this is maybe my ego, but I really believe that all the bars and all the security systems on Melrose is because of this guy. There weren't bars on the windows on Melrose, up and down Melrose. What he would do is he'd get up pre-dawn or wait till pre-dawn, get somebody's car, wait till pre-dawn, get a cinder block brick, throw it through the window. Now, mind you, I only mentioned alcohol once so far. Listen to this thinking. Listen to this thinking. He'd crash through the window, run in, grab racks of clothes, grab whatever, throw it in the car, and bring it to my house. So I went into the retail set, well, wholesale clothing business. And when I figured out what you would think that, I would say, "Oh no, I can't mess with you." Because see, I'm not criminal minded. I can't mess with you because, oh, something's wrong. No, I join in. just love me. I'm going to be your, before they even use the phrase ride or die, I'm going to be the Bonnie to your Clyde. Then I had a neighbor that was downstairs, and he had an old Ford pickup truck. You know, the kind that you shift in the column. See, I know how to drive a stick shift, but this was a shift in the column, an old Ford pickup truck. And he said, go ask your neighbor, can you use the pickup truck? I got a lick. I said, okay, my dumb behind. So I go ask the neighbor, can I borrow your truck for a minute? I'm going to go, and I got to run an errand. We need a truck. We need to move some furniture. So we go up to one of these really, really high-end furniture stores on Melrose. He tells me, pull around the corner, park on the side, keep the engine rolling. The sun is just about to come peek over the horizon. I'm sitting there with the engine rolling. Rolling. Now, this is me. I'm terrified. See, I'm scared of police. I don't know if it's a healthy fear. I don't know what it is, but I'm scared of the police. I'm scared of all of that. But I'm sitting there because I got to do this for him. Next thing you know, I hear the big crash. I hear the alarm go off, and I see him running in and out the stores. He's throwing chairs and rugs and expensive furniture and expensive pictures and all kind of stuff in the back of this truck. Jumps in the truck, say, go, and here we go. I think I must have stripped about 8 gears. Here we go, flying down Melrose, down Fairfax, all the way to my house. We get in, I pass out for 2 days. My nerves were so shot, I passed out for 2 days. That was him. One day he went to jail, and I'm telling you these stories because it's my thinking. Now, alcohol is mixed in all along, and other party favors are mixed in definitely all along. But my thinking, what in me made me think that that was smart, that that was wise, that that was godly? It was none of that going on. I just wanted to be with somebody that liked me. So we started having these sales, and we selling stuff, and then one day he didn't come home. I told him, I can't do this anymore. He didn't come home. He ended up getting a year in jail. So like most jailhouse men, they always find God. And not only do they always find God, they start doing all this drawing and poetic writing and beautiful stuff and the collect calls. I think my phone bill went up to like $5,000 back in the day. I couldn't pay it. He had me so mesmerized and hypnotized. He said, you see that star by the moon? Go outside. And I looked at the star by the moon. He said, I'm looking at the same star. And I'm like, yeah, I'm accepting collect calls. Just insanity. Insanity. But the thing that had me more terrified than anything, why is it when men go to jail, they want nude pictures of everybody? And guess what? I got a friend to come over to take nude pictures of me. Don't nobody on it. There's 99 of y'all on here. I'm 99, 98 of y'all. If you go tell, I'm going to fight you. So I get all these poses, naked, spread open, hallelujah, doing the YMCA with my legs, all of that, just taking pictures and bubble baths and all that, and I send the pictures to him, but I know that he's got all these pictures. Don't laugh at me, Gingy. I've got all these pictures of me. Well, of course, when he went to jail, I got to drink more. Of course, when he went to jail, I got to do those other things even more. I'm on a run by then. I done lost my man. I'm singing blues songs. I'm crying to Sade. I mean, it's just ridiculous. And then all of a sudden he gets out. Now, between the time he went to jail, I'm starting to hit a bottom. I'm going drinking. Now I'm no longer going to the club. I'm inviting random people that I don't know to my house, using my house as the spot, laying up, you stepping over people because they brought the package and they brought the alcohol. I'm drinking alcohol out of the trash can with cigarette butts in it. I'm just a mess. I'm not eating. I'm not taking any water, no sustenance, nothing. And I'm just drinking nonstop. When I get too drunk, then I got to take some over-the-counter medication to level me out. I mean, I'm an alcoholic of the worst variety. Anything that alters my right now being, I have to take it. He comes home with a photo album of all my pictures. I'm so terrified of him showing that photo album to somebody. I'm like, please give me the photo album. He wouldn't give it to me. By this time, here's where it goes left. By this time, I started going to Alcoholics Anonymous because I hit a bottom on that other stuff. I took a drink one time and the drink didn't do anything. I took another drink that time and it didn't do anything. And something that didn't come from my thinking between my ears, it came from my soul, from my gut. A voice said, go home. I was in a motel with a good friend of mine, and I said, let me go home. And I went home and I fought that detox out, and I laid and I sweated and I cried, and my heart was racing and skipping beats and out of order. I think to this day I still have arrhythmia because alcohol affected my body so badly that I didn't even urinate. I didn't use the bathroom. I didn't have anything. My skin was gray. Everything looked horrible to me. I hadn't looked in a mirror in a couple of years because I was scared of what I'd see. When I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 80 pounds. I started coming to the rooms because I went to my mom's house. I said I was too scared to go back to my apartment. I went to my mom's house, and she proceeded to help me move my stuff into her garage, and I stayed in the spare bedroom in my mom's house because I didn't want to go home. I was scared to be alone. And here comes this dude out of jail trying to convince me, let's go get an apartment. I told him I can't do that. By that time, I'd been introduced to you guys. And I was so afraid of doing the wrong thing because I didn't want what I had. I don't know what it was at that time that had me to stop. But today I understand that it was God's grace and my cooperation. Now, I didn't know I was cooperating. I ain't read a book. I ain't did a step. I ain't said a prayer except for God help me. I didn't do none of the stuff that they say to keep you sober, but something made me surrender. See, today we tell you, you got to be willing. You got to have the gift of desperation. You got to get with a group of drunks. You got to be willing. But, today all I know is surrender looks like this. And what's amazing about the gift and the miracle and the phenom of all of that is I don't know when my hands are up. I may think my hands are up. I may swear up on my children's breath my hands are up. But it's only, like Candace said, in the action that I know I've surrendered. I had no clue. So I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by that time, I started meeting you guys. You guys hugged me, embraced me, and you made me feel like everything was okay. And you spoke the love language that I've been searching for through men all my life. You hugged me. You nurtured me. You let me put my head on your shoulders. You let me cry on you. I heard you tell your truths and your stories. I was amazed at the boldness, the holy boldness that you had to stand in front of a group of 150 people at 3900 Santa Barbara, and you stood there and told your stories. I saw grown-ass women and grown-ass men crying in a fetal position, and when they come down off that podium, the men would embrace him and hold him and hug him. Nobody laughed at him, and if we did laugh, everybody laughed in unison. It was something so pure and so beautiful about the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. I said, I like this place. I like these people. Nobody seemed to want to get between my legs. Nobody wanted, I didn't have to bargain with that one thing that I'd bargained with all my life. So by the time the guy gets out of jail, he's trying to bargain with me and I'm trying to hold on. And I'm so scared of relapsing because I kept hearing relapse and relapse and relapse and relapse. I went to he was one of my first sponsors. It was my male sponsor. I went to Greg Little. Bless his heart, rest in peace. I went to Greg Little. I said, Greg, I still got some artwork and I still got some furniture that the guy I used to date stole. I'm already on the amends. Now, I ain't did nothing with 1, 2, 3, or 4, but I'm already seeing that 8th, 9th step. How do I go back to the place? Greg said, leave that alone. Newcomer, I'm here to tell you, leave that alone. Stop projecting when you're not there yet. No, we're not. Like they always say, are we there yet? You're not there yet. Be in the peace and the comfort of where you are. If you knew, you better celebrate your newness, because when life kicks in and when the steps kick in and you start uncovering, discovering, discarding, you're going to be sitting up there going, oh my God. It's enough to deal with life on life's terms where you at. So just be where you be. Be where you at. I know this is improper language. Just be where you at. It's so nice. Get some stuff. Then you got mortgages, you got kids, you got grandkids, you got jobs, you got to look at 401ks, you got to see if you can get some benefits. There's a lot that comes with life. So when you know, and especially if you're sitting in a recovery program and somebody's taking care of you and feeding you and you got, just be new, baby. Just be new. Just let the alcohol get out your system. Let the scrambled brains rejuvenate themselves. So when I get into the rooms and I'm following the directions and they say get a book and I get into this book and then all of a sudden say you got to get a sponsor. I said, what's that? That's somebody that's the connector between you and God. I call it the extension cord or the power strip between me and God. To this day, I always have a power strip and have a spare on top of that. Because if that power strip go out, I got somebody like a Ron White to call. I got a Reggie White to call. I got a Candace. If I needed Candace, I know I could call Candace. Because I'm going to have to run myself past somebody. Going to Catholic school was amazing to me because Catholic school went a little something like this. Catholic school was the place where you followed the rules of the nuns and the priests. I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous with a big resentment against the nuns and the priests, and I didn't mess with God because he was petty. God would damn you. He was punitive. You're going to be locked up in cell block D. You're going to have leprosy. Your arms going to fall off. Your legs going to fall off. If you don't follow the Ten Commandments, you're damned, and you're going to go to hell, and you're going to fry. I'm thinking of chicken. That's all I think. I'm going to be a fried piece of chicken, and I'm going to die. I had the wrong perception of God because it was the God that was given to me as a kid. So let me tell you another quick story. So drinking, after I was separated from alcohol, now I have this thinking and this living issue. And you guys said, that's all right. We're going to work on all of that. So I got a sponsor and I started doing the steps. I'm going to talk about Catholic school in a minute. I got a sponsor. I started working through the steps, and it took me like a year and a half to do an inventory because it was too laborious. I didn't feel like writing about it. I thought it was just that I didn't feel like it, but it was fear. You know, fear is the corroding thread. They tell me in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, fear is the corroding thread. So one day I was doing some prayer and meditation, and that's one good thing about meditation, just sitting back and thinking. Stuff starts to dawn on you. Fear is the corroding thread that goes between each and every defect. It sews them all together in a cute little ugly little pattern. It sews it. So if I sewed fear in between selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seekingness, resentment, fear, immoral sex conduct, the seven deadly sins, and I draw them all together, it's a big cluster. It's a mess. Fear is the motivating factor behind every defect that I have. I didn't know that. It took you guys to take that big book of Alcoholics Anonymous and break it down. Because when I first read that book, it bored the hell out of me. I didn't know what ye old Grenadier pot meant. I didn't know have nothing in common with Bill W. nor Dr. Bob. I didn't know what they meant. Stock market 19. What? I don't know nothing about that. I'm a black chick in 1988 just trying to get the other stuff and the alcohol out of my system. You talk about what? It took a village to break that book down for me. To put me in that book, to place me in a modern day dilemma of what was wrong with me. Let me go back just a little bit. So when I go to Catholic school, in 2003, I met a guy during an adulterous relationship, and we decided to move to Atlanta. And that's where I'm broadcasting from now. And I got a phone call from a friend. And she said, there's some attorneys looking for you. And I'm like, and it was an old elementary school friend. You know, elementary school and Catholic school goes from first to eighth grade. So I called these people and they said, do you know this Father so-and-so? Father R. I'll call him Father R. I'm like, yeah. Now, this is after having done tons and tons and tons of inventory, sponsoring, speaking, sharing my story, sharing my experience, my strength, and my hope, doing all the 12 steps, staying up underneath the breastplate of my sponsor, following direction, because I think I'm pretty easy to sponsor. I credit myself as being pretty much a good follower of directions. Not all the time. I have a quiet resistance, but I'm not going outward saying I ain't doing that, and all the head and clapping. I'm not doing none of that. I don't get all into that attitude. What I do, I follow directions because I'm afraid not to. And it's not been one leader in my spiritual walk that has lied to me, that has told me anything that was to their advantage. Everything I've been told has been basically to my advantage. But when I gather the information from the spiritual advisor, it's up to me to put it into action, to do the litmus test to see if what they're saying is right. They used to say, you can do it this way or we'll gladly refund your misery. Well, that's true. So when I'm doing this work and I'm doing this work and I get this call and I talk to the lawyers, and it was December 30th, I'll never forget. And they said, we have two more days, January 1st, and the case will be closed. It was for child molestation in the Archdiocese of Los Angeles. Was prosecuted. There were 12 African-American girls that was part of this big, 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 big group of people lawsuit. And I had totally forgotten about it. Now, you know how we do the fourth and the fifth step. It says, take down the book and examine the previous steps and make sure you've told everything you can, stuff that's related to a resentment. And I've done that many a times. This never came up. So when I sat there and I'm like, wow, and all of a sudden it started flooding back like it just like somebody opened the dam, and they asked me these questions and I gave them the information and they said, okay, thank you. They took my deposition. I was sitting under a hair dryer in a beauty salon preparing to move to Atlanta, Georgia the next day. They asked for us to come back to LA. I went to my boss that I gotten a job here in Atlanta. We didn't even have to show up. They settled. Let me explain to you real quick, and I know this has nothing to do with what you guys think is alcoholism, but what it was that these priests and these nuns in archdiocese, they had moved the priests around whenever they were accused of molestation. This Father R had been molesting kids from Orange County all the way up, all the way from the 50s up to the 60s and 70s. All these years, and all the archdiocese did was move them around. So the insurance company was fighting the archdiocese, said, we're not paying you anything. So that's what the fight was. I was awarded. It was all on CNN. I was sitting at work. Somebody said, go downstairs to the kitchen, to this big cafeteria, and look. And I sat there, and I'm looking. I don't see any report. And the ticker tape at the bottom said, Los Angeles Archdiocese settled. Now, let me explain to you what that has to do with the program. I hadn't forgiven. Oh, I did my eighth step. I did my ninth step. I had done my steps with everything. How do I forgive what I don't know? I didn't know I had to forgive them because they weren't even on my inventory. They weren't a part of what I thought was the problem. I had been touched and fondled as a kid, but I didn't realize it. See, what I'm saying to you, friends, is that I don't drink because I like the taste of alcohol. I drink because I like what it does to me and for me. It pushes back those deep, dark secrets. It pushes back those memories that I don't want to look at. It makes me feel like right now is okay, that I'm settled, that I'm okay. I like how that feels going down. I like how it makes me just feel numb. I wish I could stay in that disposition of numbness, that I don't feel nothing. I wish I could just stay there. And when the alcohol starts wearing off, then I get sad. So I drink some more because I want to reach that pinnacle again. I want to feel that feeling one more time. I want to sit in the feeling of nothingness. I don't want to feel nothing. Yeah, I came in here thinking it was my mother. Yeah, I think I came in here because I was thinking my mother got married 5 times and she couldn't control her anger and she liked throwing stuff at people. Yeah, I thought it was because I had a brother who would always get beat up and I always had to go rescue him. Yeah, I thought it's such a plethora of things. It's something you got to work on for the rest of your life. I remember after I left my first sponsor and did my first inventory, I went to my sponsor, Betty T, who's gone on to the big meeting in the sky. I was with her for 26 years solid. And I asked Betty, one more time, I'm saved up and I'm doing another inventory and I'm doing another inventory. I said, Betty, how long am I have to write this? She said, baby, for the rest of your life, you're going to always have to do self-examination. Now, when she said it in a chunk like that, I just saw tons and tons of trees and paper dying. I'm like, oh, my God, am I just relegated to that? But what you guys showed me is that I'm not relegated to having to write a 4-step every single time I have a resentment. I have that saving grace of 10, baby. Do you know the first half of my recovery, I didn't even look at a 10th step. I didn't know. I just let it pile up. Then I'd write a four step. But the miracle is once you do one four step, it's just ridiculous. I had 300 and some odd. I was so scared to miss somebody. I put down everything. The man who walked up the telephone pole and knocked the leaves off, the phone company man. I put down everything. And when I read my first fifth step, my sponsor laughed through three quarters of it. She said, girl, that ain't no resentment. I said, it's not. She said, no. We laughed. We skipped it and went on. I was so afraid to make a mistake because I didn't want to go back to that 80-pound little girl searching for love. Going with the sway of whatever man I was with. I was with a man at 18 one more time that convinced me that if I drank enough alcohol and I did enough of the other party favors, I would build confidence. This is how my mind was. This is how immature, insecure I was. He said, if you stand out, Candace, on the corner of Sunset and Crescent Heights in front of Carlos and Charlie's Hello Walls, and you get enough tricks, the more money you make, that means that you are really, really desirable. And that should build your self-esteem. And I believed it and did it. Now, I didn't get but a 30-day chip being a prostitute. That didn't work long because I ended up in Sybil Brand after about 30 days and went to jail. That was real smart. But I tried it because he was my sponsor, quote unquote. And the cool thing about him, I did whatever he wanted me to do. I ran up $2,500 credit cards. Just love me. Just love me. If he told me he liked me a whole lot, I did degrading things. He had me do stuff that was, I can't even explain it on this tape, the stuff that he had me do. I did whatever that man wanted me to do. But what's amazing is I see sponsees tell me these stories, but they come into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous where the life-saving program is, and they want to buck that. You want to buck that, but you're willing to crawl around on your knees and have gang bangs and do whatever insanity that alcohol drives you to do, but you got a problem with somebody trying to help you save your damn life. That amazes me. Maybe you ain't did this yet. Oh, for those of you listening, I got two hands in the air. It's called the sign of surrender. It's a universal sign. Guess what? Even in London, they know what this means. So the guy that did all that stuff to me, one day I'm sober, about 2-3 years ago, and I get an inbox on my Facebook, and it's him. And when I saw his face, the blood drained from my body. You ever have an anxiety attack where the blood drains from your body, you get this shivers, you get the hair stand up on the back of your neck, you get goosebumps? I saw his face and I knew exactly who he was. He was a little older, he had a beard, he's named himself Shabazz, Shalom, Sasakas, whatever them names, and had on a little yarmulke thing, and Shaka Khan, shut up Ronnie, and all that kind of stuff. And I looked at it and I got terrified. I didn't know what to do. I'm looking around, nobody's in the house but me. And he inboxed me. He said, hello, Leslie. He was 25. I was 18. He wouldn't even bail me out of Sybil Brand. He wouldn't even bail me out of jail. I was homeless because that man wouldn't come and help me. I was homeless on Venice Beach at 18 years old. I was homeless. All I had was a pair of roller skates, some corduroy pants, and a tube top. And I didn't have any clothes. I didn't have anywhere to stay. I just skated up and down the boardwalk. I've been homeless. See, these are the things I forgot about. But when I hear stories like Candace's and some of you other women's, I'd be like, wait a minute, I did that. I'm so glad that God lets it seep out a little bit at a time, because I really believe if it all came flooding back, I'd probably somewhere be in a mental ward. I'm so glad God's grace and his mercy lets me uncover, discover, discard in little bitty pieces. And you can't eat an elephant in one bite. You got to eat it in little bitty pieces. And my recovery and my destruction is such a big elephant, I couldn't take it all if I remembered it at one time. But what you guys have done, it's like the, anybody cooking here, you know what a pressure cooker look like? It got that little toggle thing on, go you know, let some of the steam out at the top. I'm so glad that this program is built like that, because I don't think I could take it all, because I'm emotionally sensitive and I'm emotionally disturbed most of the time, even today. Ask somebody. So the guy that hits me on the inbox, that had me prostituting myself, that I sold my soul to, asked me for my phone number. I gave him my phone number. Because see, my head said, now knowing the steps, my head said, I'm going to tell him he owes me an amends. And like Ralph White said, that's step 9.5. Where you get to tell somebody where they owe you an amends? Well, I was finna violate that step. First of all, I was rehearsing. I got double digits now. But what was amazing was that man called me and we caught up and we talked. And we talked a lot about God. It was nothing flirtatious, it was nothing. And then he said, I'm calling to apologize for what I did to you when you were younger. I was young, I was insane, and that was not nice what I did to you. And I'm just asking for your forgiveness. You know, people know how to make amends, even if they ain't in the program. And if that's the best he could do, you know what? I could not tell him no. My program taught me I have to accept what they give me. I have to forgive in order to be forgiven. That's what my ninth step taught me. And when he said that, all of that conversation and all that smart, swanky, flip lip stuff disappeared. And I said on the phone, you're forgiven, baby. It's okay. We were both sick. I looked around like, who said that? This program has you doing stuff when it's embedded in your soul. See, it's a design. It's a blueprint. It's a design for living. But once you catch on, don't try to catch up with the life you lost. Just catch on. When you catch on and you jump on that merry-go-round and you catch on and you ride and you ride and ride, and all of a sudden you caught on, and then your life will start to catch up with you. And Candace mentioned something about she looked older then than she does now. It's something about the life-saving, spiritual-saving thing about these rooms. I look younger than my friends who still out there doing they do whatever they do. Even if not, they're not drunks. Living in this spiritual life, it reverses your age. It reverses your spiritual youth. It does something to you. And then when you have that fourth dimension lifestyle. See, I found out in doing these steps, yeah, it's good to gather information. Go through the big book, go through the 12 and 12, give big book studies, give 12 and 12 studies, listen to 5,900 resentments, the fifth steps, and going through this and talking to people, whether you sponsor them or not, people call you and say they want to run this past you. Just giving and giving and giving. And sometimes I would be so tired when I get in a relationship and the other half is not working the steps like I think they should be working the steps, or even according to the book, and they're not doing it. I asked my sponsor one day, say, why I always got to be the one to make amends? Why I always got to be the one to correct myself? Why I always got to be the one to look at my defects? Can't they see their defects? She said, I'm not talking to them. I'm talking to you. We can't change them. It says my whole attitude and outlook upon the person has to change. They can stay just as special ed, short yellow bust as they want to. How are you going to change to adjust yourself to life? This program teaches me how to get that confidence. See, I don't want nothing to do with self anymore. Well, you need some self-esteem. You need some self-worth. You need some self-this and self-that. Self is my problem. Page 63 says, if I'm full of self, it's selfishness and self-seeking and self-loathing and all kind of forms of self. 62 talks about all kind of forms of self. Well, self is the problem. It says selfishness and self-seeking is the root of my problem. It's the root. Then they turn back around and said that you're beyond human aid, but then they put people like Candace and Sandy and Steve Lamb and Richard B. They put people in your face and say, but you need these people to help you. Well, you told me I was beyond human. There's a lot of oxymorons in here. But what I've come to understand about this spiritual walk is it's designed to give you another point of view. Remember when you were one of my favorite toys when I was a kid was a kaleidoscope. Remember the kaleidoscope? You put it up to your eye, and then when you held it up to the sun, and then you turn part of it, and the little crystal things would change, and the view would change, and all that stuff. And then, you guys are a kaleidoscope of collective energy from the Most High. You give me another perspective, another point of view, another way of thinking. Because see, I have tunnel vision. I think that my thinking is the only thinking that there is. But when I call one of you in a moment of desperation, in a moment I have a quandary, I have a dilemma, I don't know how to solve this, what's my next right action? How dare I have the arrogance to think that I got the answer? You know, my sponsor, I went back to one of my first sponsors now once Betty died. And I used Ronnie. Ronnie was my bookmark for a while. And Ronnie's never judgmental. And he would always listen to the whole sentence. You know, it's something about learning how to be a good listener around here. Sponsor somebody and sit and listen to them. But see, for me, my sponsor said, I'll give you 3 to 5 minutes. After that, I got the story. See, I usually tell them, stop, I got it. Stop. Because then they start repeating themselves. No, you're not going to drag me through your mental war field up in here. Let's stop. And I take mental bullet points. Okay, let's start from the top. And we come up with a solution. Because I always joke about it, but it's really no joke. It's like this. I got half a brain. You got half a brain. And between our two half of brains, we can figure some things out together. That's my way of acting humble in the midst of them going through what they're going through. I had a mother that had lupus since the time I was 13 years old. And in her lupus, she had strokes and heart attacks and cancer scares and couldn't get out the bed. And this is before they even knew what lupus was. Lupus erythematosus. I wrote a paper about it when I was 13 years old. I was the oldest child of two, and I took care of my mother. I learned to cook, clean, wash clothes, iron my pleated uniforms, and do all of that household grown people stuff. I was grown before I was able to be grown. My mother got sicker and sicker. My mother was the one that always paid her bills on time. We never had no electricity. We never didn't have any food in the house. My mother took good care of. I had a car when I was 16 years old. And my mother got so sick that I couldn't take care of her. I had two kids. I was getting ready to get a divorce from my husband. I had a whole house. I had a full-time job. I had all y'all 12-step. My kids are sober children, and they never seen me drunk, and the fathers were never drunk. And then all of a sudden, here's my mother. And I tried every imaginable remedy. I brought her to my house, let her stay at the house. Couldn't do that. I can't lift you and bathe you. Those of you who take care of moms, I applaud you. I can't do it. So Betty T was a nurse, and Betty said, baby, tell me the truth. She said, baby, can you take care? Are you willing to take care of your mom like that? She says, just me and you here right now. Just me and you. And I looked at her. I said, I can't do it. She says, okay, baby. So she found a place that takes people into their homes. It was one of her nursing training nurses that she trained. And this lady took care of my mother for 12 years. Till she couldn't do it no more. And then my mother went into a board of care at Sentinel Hospital. And one day my mother didn't wake up. Mother's Day 2017. And the girl that worked there was somebody who happened to be in a program that I had met. And I'd give her extra money to take extra care of my mom, get her nails done, cut her hair. And Sharon called me. And my mom's body was still there. She said, you want me to send you pictures in case anything goes wrong? Now, it sounds morbid to some people. I said, yeah, send me pictures. And when I looked at those pictures, and I still have those pictures, my mother looked like she was asleep. She went to sleep. But like Jennifer, I listened to Jennifer yesterday. I had no dues to pay, no access to grind. I treated her well as I could. I made sure she had everything she wanted. I made total amends to her. And the woman who wouldn't tell me she loved me, and the woman who didn't know how to hug me, and the woman who didn't know how to give me the love that I needed as a child, I was the one to say, I love you. And she would respond accordingly, I love you too. And she had this little baby voice. Because I don't know if you know about Alzheimer's patients, but they become childlike. She said, I love you too. And then when I would come and visit her, she would say, oh, you look so pretty. The shit I had been looking for as a kid, she finally gave it to me. But it wasn't because she gave it to me. It's because you guys gave me a program to accept her exactly what she as she was, and to make amends to her by action. Action. Information with education does not equal transformation, baby. Transformation comes when you put your feet to the fire and you walk through it. And when she closed her eyes, I had no regret. That's why when my mother's anniversary come around, I'm not laid up in a fetal position crying. See, I have this idea, maybe I'm just wrong, but people cry real hard and shit because something you didn't do right. That's my attitude. Now I try to remember the good. She and Betty T made me the woman I am today. So now I am no longer subject to the man or the woman. I got a couple minutes. No longer subject to the man or the woman in these rooms. I'm strong in my demeanor. I'm strong on my stance. I could be wrong as two left shoes. And until I find that I'm wrong, I'm going to stand on that shit. Because I worked hard to have character, baby. I worked hard to have people love me. Because I give that love. You can't get what you ain't given. The 11th step says something so beautifully. I had a speaker recently, and he says, the reason why the 11th step is so powerful because it always says bring. Read that 11th step and see how many times it says bring. Where there is darkness, bring the light. Where there is sadness, bring happiness. Where there is a lack of love, bring love. Where there's a lack of forgiveness, bring forgiveness. Forgive those trespassers who trespassed against you as and the same that I have to do. I have to forgive you in spite of your ass. Whether you forgive me or not. I can't take revenge anymore. I can't. It's just not comfortable in my soul. I just don't sleep right today. Today, what I try to do is be the best person. And when I see my faults, I try to apologize as soon as possible, make amends as soon as possible. I don't see everything, but I see a whole lot. And the third eye in my fourth dimension living, when I talk to my sponsees, it goes a little something like this. Girl, how did you know that? I said, I just knew. I know what you're doing. I know why you avoid me because you went back to the man. You had my permission to relapse because I relapsed on men many a day. And when he hurts you again, I'll be right here for you, loving you until you love yourself. So if you're new around here and you think it's going to be an overnight matter, baby, this is 33 years of working hard on this program and I'm not here to play with nobody. And I like to laugh a lot. So if you ever get sad and if you're walking around here looking all glum and you're talking in a monotone and you all sad, you might want to check and see what is it that I'm not doing to smiling and laughing like Candace and Leslie and Reggie, because this is a laughable thing. It's hysterical, the insanity that we go through. But I've been restored to sanity and I don't miss nothing. So I hope you stay all the way awoke, all the way aware, and all the way willing. We can't do nothing with you until you surrender. And when you surrender, we got you, boo. We got you. My name is Leslie Strange. I'm a recovering alcoholic. Thank you.